Thanks everybody for coming. This is the first seminar of the Hellenic Observatory seminar series for the term. And I should say it's great to be back. I've been away for the term and I missed all this amazing event. It's a great pleasure to have today three, actually, of the four co-authors of this paper slash report. They're all very good friends and very strong links to the to the Hellenic Observatory, but also to the LSC. One of the links that we have, which go beyond friendship and the LSC, is that they're all founding members of the what used to be the Greek Labour Market Research Network in the UK, which organised a couple of conferences, one of which was also in LSC a few years ago. They all, as I said, all the presenters here have a PhD from LSC from different departments, but they all work on the area of employment relations and the labour market from different disciplinary perspectives, and I think this is also a strength of the team, of the project, and of the paper they're going to be presenting. I'm going to say very few things. Andreas Kornelak is a senior lecturer at King's in the Department of Management, if I'm not wrong, and he has a PhD from here, from the European Institute of LSE. Koremos Kerizian is a senior lecturer at Bristol at the University of West of England, and he has a PhD from the Department of Management.
Yes.
What used to be employment?
Industrial relations.
From LSE. And Panos Kobotas is a senior lecturer at Portsmouth, and he has a PhD from the Law Department here at LSE. The missing link doesn't have a PhD from LSE, so we didn't allow him to. Michalis Velizgiotis. The paper you're presenting today has been funded by the Hellenic Observatory, the research projects that we fund, and I think this is the paper version of the work that you have done. Okay, so you're going to have a presentation for 45 minutes, and then
you're going to keep time.
Well, Vasilis, thank you very much for all the introductions. I have to say that it is a great pleasure for me to be back here in this room and in this building. Used to be part of the audience, now I'm part of the presenters. I would like to acknowledge gratefully financial support from the LSC and National Bank of Greece Small Grants Scheme that has funded this small research project. I wanted to say a few other things about Vasilis' introduction, sort of, as usual, took away all my important points and jokes. So I'd like also to mention that, as Vasilis noted, that this is part of a larger project, a larger research report, which is published at the LSC website and has looked at different aspects of labour market regulation. We have looked at employment protection legislation, framework, as well as the mechanisms to tackle undeclared and informal employment arrangements. So this is just a slice from that long report, and we're hoping to gradually turn it into research papers and submit it to journals, hopefully. So without any further delay, I'd like to start with this particular presentation, which is based on the paper also published by Greece Papers, the Hellenic Observatory discussion papers. So in terms of plan of our presentation, we'll start with a bit about motivation for this research and the context, a brief review of the academic and policy debates that are related with this research agenda. The main questions are research design, and then present some of our emerging findings and what are sort of the explanations and interpretation of those findings that we'd like to draw our attention to. So, I mean, the motivation, the general context of this research project. There's an academic part and there's a policy part in this research project. The more academic part relates with a long literature, a large body of research that is looking at trajectories of institutional change across advanced industrialized markets, specifically looking at institutions in the labor markets or labor market institutions, and how these chains, sort of what is the rationale behind change, what is the process of change, why they change, and what is the pace of change. At the backdrop of that academic literature, we have an empirical context, obviously in Greece, that is characterized by an unprecedented economic and social crisis. That is linked, of course, with the well-known bailout packages, and part of this agenda, part of these bailout policies, have included an element of reforming labor market institutions, very explicitly. And kind of the more, I'd say, the more broader policy and academic debates, policy in terms of international organizations, policies like OECD, regarding appropriate levels of labor market regulation, but also academic work, mainly from labor economists, on the role of labor market institutions as frictions, and their relationship with employment levels. Again, so we sort of tap on that debate as well. And we try to bring everything in an interdisciplinary project. One of the strengths of this particular research team is that it has included, as Vasily said, investigators with different disciplinary backgrounds. So in our team, we had an economist, a law specialist, and then employment relations and political economy specialists. So we sort of tried to have a look from an interdisciplinary perspective and try to speak to different literatures and different questions. The sort of running thread, the running theme behind this this project is the question: is there an empirical case for deregulation? There have been arguments on both sides of the debate in terms of what is the appropriate level of regulation and what kind of institutional arrangements lead to better outcomes, not only in terms of levels of employment, but also in terms of job quality. So, for example, there has been that's a long literature on the voice effect of trade unions that goes back to Richard Freeman's work. And the relationship between labor market institutions and competitiveness, and how far reforming labor market institutions will or will not improve competitiveness, and what type of competitiveness it will improve. There has been a long literature and reviews, sort of state-of-the-art reviews of this literature, have been critical of studies that make the policy case for deregulation. Academics have been always more careful than policymakers on that realm. There have been inconclusive studies on the relationship between labor market institutions and other employment performance, unemployment. Various parametric models have been very sensitive to different specifications, and sort of it is a largely inconclusive debate. On the other hand, there has been a visible trend and a strong policy consensus towards deregulation, or, depending on the perspective, some sort of re-regulation of labour market institutions. And that is visible in current frameworks as part of new economic governance in the European Union. Evident in country-specific recommendations that have been provided by the European Commission to a number of countries, not only Greece. We're talking about sort of a broader trend. The Commission has urged countries to review wage safety mechanisms and review employment protection legislation systems. And this review has included some sort of recalibration or deregulation of existing systems. In the case of Greece, that type of policy recommendations have been more explicit as part of the bailout packages and in the form of the well-known internal devaluation. But we need to stress that this is not sort of, this is a broader picture here. It's not only about Greece. Similar policies in different degrees appeared in the rest of the European periphery. So even if it was not part of the bailout package, we can see similar reforms taking place in Spain, in Italy, in Portugal as well. And there has been literature documenting that trend. What we sort of, out of this broader context, what we're interested in focusing at is the process of change, especially in the case of Greece, which was abrupt and there was no social dialogue involved in the sort of implementation of labour market changes. Also from the wide range of labour market institutions, here we focus on wage setting. Collective bargaining and especially minimum wage setting. The process of institutional change is important in the political economy literature because it may hinder and or enable the successful implementation of change. And there are elements that the literature has already emphasized as important either with regard to the process of institutional change, either the pace of change, whether it's incremental, slow, building up over time, or abrupt, and the mode of change, whether it's negotiated between social actors affected by the changes in institutions or it's sort of government initiated unilateral. In the case of Greece, it is important to emphasize that the bailout agreements and everything, and sort of Troika and everything, paid lip service to the idea of, okay, social dialogue has to be there. But in reality, that never happened. So the process of change was really unilateral and abrupt. So our sort of more specific research questions on that, on the basis of that background, is how do social partners, that was the interest in this project, perceive the construction and reconstruction of institutions in this time of transformative change and especially crisis. We're interested to see whether actors' interests and ideas converge or diverge with respect to the initiated and implemented changes. And also, we'll try to gauge the social partners' perceived effectiveness of the adopted policies. It is important to emphasize here the perceived effectiveness, because we're talking about perceptions, because the actual effectiveness is something first, it's very difficult to pin down, because we never know what would be the counterfactual if they never happened. The second element that we try to emphasize is we'll start with the basic hypothesis that the majority of those institutional changes in the area of collective bargaining and labor and collective bargaining and minimum wages, they sort of hint a pro-business or pro-market rationale behind them. The interesting question is whether the business representatives, the representative associations of business in Greece, whether they sort of agree with that direction of change. And that sort of is the expected preliminary hypothesis in our investigation. So in terms of research design methodology, this is a critical case study research design. In terms of the literature of institutional change, Greece is pinned down as a critical case because there has been a large degree of institutional change in a small amount of time under conditions of crisis. And this is an important, institutions have changed both in terms of magnitude and in terms of timing very quickly. And we'd like to see how that sort of extraordinary conditions have an impact on the perceptions of actors, of social actors, on their effectiveness and desirability of those labour market institutions. In terms of data collection strategies, we followed elite interviewing We conduct interviews with key informants. The field work took place in July, in August 2016. We interviewed representatives from the key associations in Greece, GSE, SEV, but also the representatives of small employers, small medium-sized employers like GSE, SE, representatives from the Ministry of Labour, so the government or government agencies like the Labour Inspectorate and the Organisation for Mediation and Arbitration. And those interview data were supplemented the analysis of also primary data like press releases, position papers from those associations. So, sort of after giving you this background of this research, I now turn to my colleague here to present some of the findings.
Okay, thank you very much, Andre. Do I use this?
Yes.
Good. Now, before I present the empirical results, I just want to make a small introduction on what actually happened in Greece in these years. I'm sure you may be aware of these issues, and I'm not going to discuss them in detail. We have already published this in another Greece paper back in 2011, I remember, Andrea, where all these debates are more analytically presented there. But it serves the purpose of today's presentation just to remind us what the changes actually were. Now, we need to keep in mind, of course, that all the changes took place because the government and the Troika wanted to reduce labor costs. I mean, that was the primary reason behind all changes, internal devaluation, as we say. And the reason they wanted to do that was to help businesses become more competitive, especially in external markets. So they implement quite a lot of changes that's focused not only on collective bargaining, of course, on the national minimum wages, as we'll discuss later in a couple of slides, but also on other aspects of the labor market, such as employment protection legislation, flexible employment, and so on and so forth. These aspects are not discussed in this particular presentation. We have presented them in detail in our full report, which you will be able to find online at the Hellenic Observatory publication page. We also need to keep in mind that all the changes that took place, and the majority of the changes, happened within a year or two. Let's say it was a huge amount of changes, a bulk amount of changes, that took place very, very quickly, created a new and unprecedented, let's say, situation in Greece. There were radical changes, and I say radical because they changed quite a lot of the existing framework of employment relations at that time. Two laws were very important regarding collective bargaining. Of course, the first one was Law 3899 of 2010, and then Law 4024 of 2011, which supplemented, let's say, the first law and made some small minor changes to some of its provisions. The major changes that took place regarding collective bargaining in Greece were, of course, what we call in industrial relations a decentralization of collective bargaining. So, an attempt by the government and the Troika to move the level of decision making regarding wages and other terms and conditions of employment from the tripartite or the sectoral level, let's say, to the company level. Okay. So, what did they do? They introduced several changes to existing laws. The first and most important one was the possibility of signing company-level agreements by non-trade union institutions, representatives, called associations of persons. Associations of persons, as we will see later on, is a unique thing in Greece. We don't have something like that elsewhere in Europe. It was created, let's say, in 2011 as an answer, let's say, to a provision that the earlier law 3899 included and allowed people that were members of an organization, employees in an organization, to actually sit down and negotiate with their employer a collective agreement, let's say, that would be, of course, binding to the rest of the employees in that company. But the crucial point here is that this association of persons, although it can negotiate collective agreements, it's not a trade union. Which means what? It doesn't enjoy any of the rights that accompany the right of collective bargaining. So one very important such right is the right to strike, for instance. As we know from legal literature, the right to strike is a right that is secondary to collective bargaining, it is connected with that, and if you want to give purpose and meaning to the right of strike, then the right of collective bargaining needs to be in place. These associations, however, do not enjoy the right to strike. They also do not enjoy the you know, the support and the protection that trade unions or traditional trade unions do have in law. So, for instance, you know, the employer decides to fire somebody who is a member of the association of persons, they will not go through the channels, let's say, that the law you know, says that one should follow when they have to fire a trade union and so on and so forth. The second important thing that happened was that the law provided the possibility to companies that employed less than 50 employees to actually conclude collective agreements. Up to that point, only companies that employed more than 50 employees could actually sign a company-level agreement. And if you know what is going on in Greece, it was a very, very small percentage of companies in Greece, because the majority of Greek enterprises, 95%, if I remember correctly, are very, very small enterprises, employing less than 10 employees. So in order to provide the opportunity to those small companies to actually sign a collective agreement, this change had to take place in law. A third thing that happened was what we call the suspension of the favorability principle in law. And the favorability principle, if you don't know about it, is a principle that existed and still exists, actually. It has been suspended, and when the program finishes, it will go back in place. Which argues that if an employee is covered, let's say, by more than one collective agreement, then the collective agreement that is more favorable for that particular employee will apply in its case. To give a very small, very simple example, let's say, assume that one is an accountant that is employed, let's say, by a chemical industry. Okay. In Greece, the accountant may be covered by an occupational agreement signed by the accountant's union, occupational level across the country, and he or she may also be covered by a sectoral agreement that is signed by the chemical industry. Okay, so what happens there? Which agreement applies to this particular individual? The favorability principle provided, let's say, a solution to this problem, and the solution provided was that the best agreement for this particular individual will apply eventually. With the suspension of the favorability principle, this thing doesn't exist anymore, so it is up to the employer to decide which collective agreement will apply eventually to their employees. The second change that happened was, the fourth actually here, was the suspension of what we call the extension principle. And the extension principle is the principle that extends, let's say, the coverage of a collective agreement to more employees than the ones that have participated in the collective bargaining of this particular agreement. So if you are, for example, an employee in a bank that hasn't signed the collective agreement or was not part, let's say, of the employers' associations who signed the sectoral agreement in the banking sector, then the Minister of Labour, could extend the application of this agreement even in your case. And this happened if the companies actually who signed the collective agreements, you know, employed more than 50% of the employees in this particular sector. By suspending the extension principle, what happened in reality was that employers were now able, if you wish, to decide whether or not to apply a specific agreement that has been agreed on the sectoral level. So as you can appreciate, what happens with the combination of all these things was that it provided more opportunities to the employers, the law provided more opportunities to the employers to skip sectoral agreements and to decide, perhaps unilaterally or through negotiations with the company unions or associations of persons, what kind of terms and conditions of employment will be implemented in their particular staff. Okay. The second important change that concerns us of this particular paper has to do with the statutory regulation of the minimum wage. This happened in 2012. Both through Law 4046 and the Act of Cabinet Number 6, which actually provided the opportunity and provided the right to the state to decide what the level of the national minimum wage will be. Up until then, in Greece, the national minimum wage, contrary to what was happening in other European countries, was a result of collective bargaining between the tripartite social partners. Okay. This usually took place every 2 years, and the social partners sat down together and negotiated the national minimum wage for the consequent years. In 2012, however, the government, through these particular laws, an act of cabinet, decided to reduce the level of the minimum wage from 750 euros to 586 euros, and to, you know, create a statutory regulation of this particular institution, the national minimum wage. These two changes, both in the structure of collective bargaining and in the structure of the national minimum wage, were very, very important for the tripartite social partners. And if you remember, if you were reading the papers back then, you must remember that it was a period of huge conflict. I mean, the social partners didn't sit down and just accept it. What was going on, we had a tremendous amount of strikes in Greece, and at least for as long as I am around in this planet, it was the first time that I observed lockouts in Greece. Lockouts are, of course, illegal in Greece. We don't have the same system as in the UK. I remember watching and seeing posters in the streets, you know, of YSEVE and SE, these are the employers' associations representing small and medium enterprises, calling their members to shut shop as, you know, and as a reaction to what was going on in Parliament. And this was a unique case, a unique moment in Greece, as far as I remember. Quite a lot of conflict, quite a lot of reaction, of course, and the social partners did react, you know, both in the streets and through publications and articles in newspapers, etc., about all these changes. However, we believe that now when we actually ran the project 1.5 years ago, is a very opportune moment to actually understand what was going on and what went on, and perhaps to question the social partners about their perceptions about this change, with the benefit of hindsight, of course. So, as Andrea said, we conducted a huge empirical research that took place within 3 months. We interviewed quite a lot of people from all the social partners, the tripartite social partners, and we questioned them about these two aspects, the decentralization of collective bargaining and the statutory regulation of the national minimum wage. Very interestingly, we didn't plan this, but very interestingly, it did take place at the same time as the government, the Syriza government, was preparing for its first round of negotiations with the Troika. So we conducted the research in the summer, and in September 2016, the government started to renegotiate again a new package and to try to change some things in employment relations. And both these aspects, the re-centralization in this case of collective bargaining and the passage of the statutory minimum, of the passage of the national minimum wage back to the hands of the social partners, was in the agenda of the government. Okay, so it was a very, very important moment when we conducted our research. Now, as you can appreciate, of course, and as you can expect, the trade union side, the YSE, was against decentralization. I mean, we weren't, we did expect that. We weren't surprised to find this thing. And the reason they provided as, you know, as a rationale for this position that was that, you know, decentralization creates inequality in the labor market, as the current system provokes individual collective bargaining over sectoral collective bargaining, or individual bargaining over collective bargaining itself. And they also argue that more power is given to the employer side to determine unilaterally the terms and conditions of employment. What was interesting, of course, was that also employers' associations shared more or less the same opinion, not in so many words, and not using necessarily the same jargon, the same discourse, but the meaning of the saying was along these lines. And this was especially the case with the employers' associations representing small and medium enterprises, YSEVE and SA in this case. They were against decentralization of collective bargaining as it happened, as it took place. Both of these organizations said that sectoral collective bargaining is something very important, something that needs to be supported both in law and in practice, because it creates standardization and prohibits what we call the race to the bottom, unfair competition in the labor market and in the market in which they operate. What is important to take in consideration here was that these organizations represent small enterprises, as I said, that have very important ties with their personnel. So if you work, let's say, in a shop, in a catering company, or in a retail company, let's say, selling shoes or clothes in the center of Athens, and you may have two, three people working for you, you have personal relationship with these people. And employers were afraid that if they try to change things in terms of the terms and conditions of employment, this personal relationship that they have developed with their staff may be shattered. Okay. So they were conscious about this this situation. Big employers, on the other hand, SETE, who represent big industries, big businesses here, although we're not against sectoral collective bargaining per se, they favored more the company level collective bargaining. Okay, and they said very specifically that company level agreements should take precedence over sectoral agreements in this case. As our interview from Seth said, every business is aware of its own strengths and knows the level of wages that it can afford. We will see later on in the discussion why this is the case and why this discrepancy between the two kinds of employers' associations exists. Another important finding was the opinion that these social partners had about this institution of the association of persons that I mentioned earlier. Yes, of course, this can be expected. Was very critical of this measure because they viewed association of persons as employer-led structures that functioned as Trojan horses to impose managerial views on managerial conditions on the employees. The employers didn't express a clear view on this matter, but they neither endorsed it nor rejected it, which is very interesting in this case. We do know that many employers have made use of the association of persons as a way to reduce wages, but we also know from the analysis of the data that the association of persons have started to decline. And the reason for this is that employers now have started to conclude individual agreements between themselves and their employees, and then to go through the channel of the association of persons to create a semi-collective agreement. The variations, of course, of associations of persons is problematic. As I said before, it has the right to collective bargaining, but doesn't have the right to actually call a strike, or its members are not protected against authoritarian actions from management. Moreover, management may also be part of these bodies, let's say, something that is forbidden in trade union law. Hence, although they are supposed to do what the trade union does, they do not enjoy any of the privileges or protections that trade unions actually have in law. Regarding the statutory regulation of the national minimum wage, again, this was a very interesting finding. All the social partners, no exception here, wanted, and still want, for the national minimum wage to be determined through collective bargaining, through tripartite level collective bargaining. Okay. They perceived the statutory regulation of the national minimum wage as an attack on their collective autonomy and on the freedom of collective bargaining. And they also perceived this, the way that the statutory regulation took place as a question of their position as trustworthy and responsible interlocutors in the industrial relations arena. The issue of trust and responsibility is very important, and it's emerged quite often in our discussion with all the social partners. And it was, let's say, a complaint, if you wish, that all of them had, both toward the government and the Troika. There was consensus among them, as I said, regarding the determination of the national minimum wage. They want the national minimum wage to be determined by them. All of them are open regarding the process of the determination and the role that perhaps third party may play in this process, for instance, the role of experts, the role of the state, the role of a low pay commission in the UK sense, and so on and so forth. What is interesting as well is that although in that particular summer, in summer 2016, all of them, all four of them, had signed a paper actually saying that we, as the tripartite social partners in Greece, do want the national minimum wage to return to our authority and to determine it. This thing was never heard by the Troika. So in the consequent negotiations that took place 16 and 17, the Troika didn't even consider this this response. All of them as well criticized the current level of the national minimum wage. And so we were quite surprised by this because we expected at least that the employers would be in favor of a lower wage in a sense, you know, to improve their productivity, improve their costs and their survival, let's say, chances. But we observed that, as was the case with decentralization, that the small and medium enterprises, the employers association representing small and medium enterprises, did want an increase in the national minimum wage. Some of them said, like I say, that it should go back to the pre-2011 levels. Others, like YesFA and the YesA as well, said that this is something that we need to negotiate eventually. We cannot say that we want the national minimum wage to go back to 750 euros, but we need to negotiate and look at what's going on in the economy and eventually decide what the level will be. But negotiations should take place. That's the important thing. It also emerged from the interviews that the social partners were very willing to negotiate. Okay, not only wages, but also other terms and conditions of employment or other issues that have to do with the Greek economy. And I have a quote at the end of the presentation showing exactly this. They were very, very conscious of their role as forces, let's say, that could help improve the productivity and the growth of the Greek economy. We're only asking for the opportunity to engage in this kind of discussion, of negotiation. Now, when we asked the social partners about their perceptions regarding these reforms and whether they found them effective or not, whether they changed something for the better, etc., it was very interesting, again, that the small and medium enterprises said that, you know, this didn't deliver what it was supposed to be. I have a quote here from the SAA, our interview said that, as a matter of fact, our country dropped 6 places, and is now the 62nd place with their competitiveness, a fact that doesn't confirm the theory that wage reductions and employment flexibility will act to contain the level of unemployment or growth or increased growth. So although wage were reduced, this was not necessarily reflecting an increase in productivity. There were also quite a lot of side effects. That's all employers and the ESA, of course, were very aware of. The exploitation of the institution of the association of persons by certain employers, the persistence and perhaps the increase of illegal practice in the labor market. It was another important part of our research. We don't discuss it here, but you can find the relevant results in our big report, as well as Andrea said. And of course, the fact that many small and medium enterprises had closed because of the decrease in consumption and so on and so forth. So, what can we conclude out of this research? First of all, and what is very, very important to understand is that this binary, perhaps, perception that many people have about the role of employers, associations, and trade unions in Greece. Is not necessarily true. There are quite a lot of hidden fractures even within the employers' camp. So you can see the small and medium enterprises, YesFA, SA, having common, let's say, approaches to the matter regarding decentralization, minimum wage, company level agreements, etc. Whereas big employers, like SAVE or SET in this case, have quite a lot of different opinions. Social partners also unanimously supported the return to the previous system of collective bargaining of the national minimum wage, of how the national minimum wage will be determined. And of course the reason for this is both structural and economic. Structural because the negotiation of the national minimum wage was one of the most important things and perhaps the thing that provided a specific identity and power to these institutions to exist and have a presence in the employment relations system. When you take away this opportunity, this right for them, then there is a gap here that needs to be filled. And the employers' associations were not ready to fill this gap. We do know that they lost quite a lot of members as a result of these changes. We do know that they faced financial problems in some cases because membership declined. And they want, of course, this thing to come back to their hands in order to improve their power base in the employment relations model. There is also another reason, of course, and this has to do with economics and has to do with consumption. If we increase the national minimum wage, then more money will be available in the real economy to be spent. We must not forget that Greece is an economy that functions primarily on internal consumption. So much of the product that we produce and we sell in Greece are circulated, let's say, among us, or not such. You know, it's an internal economy. We don't export as much as we would like to, or we think that we should export. So there was this economic argument as well, especially from SAE, the association that represents merchants, and the SFL. Okay. For the efficacy of the reforms, yes, thank you, Vasil, I'll try to finish in 3 minutes. Regarding the efficacy of the reforms, all of them cast a doubt to the technocratic solutions that were promoted by the Troika and by the various representatives of the Troika. And all of them started questioning the role of the state. A thing that emerged out of our discussions that was that they had lost, if they ever had, trust to the state. And by trust, we mean the ability of the state to actually involve them in the process and to, of decision-making, and to take the right decisions regarding the future of the Greek economy and the Greek labor market. None of them said, and this was very important, by none, I also included the SA here, that everything was rosy and nothing had, you didn't need to change anything. On the contrary, all of them said that changes had to take place, and they were fully aware of this situation. What kind of change, of course, is a different discussion. Obviously, looking at different social partners, you come up with different approaches to this, with different answers to this question. And all of them said, of course, that the process of change should have been different. A complaint, as I said in the beginning, that all of them had was that they were left out. They felt like being left out of this process. As Andreas said, social dialogue was supposed to take place. It was part of the original memorandum of understanding, but it never took place. Or when it took place, it didn't take place in a way that was actually that actually delivered results. So social partners were being called in the Minister of Labour to discuss issues. The meeting finished in an hour, or even when it finished, no conclusions had been reached, etc. And then the government unilaterally regulated whatever they regulated. Okay. The important thing, of course, here, and I say this with a bit of hindsight now, is that the Troika also didn't seem to take place to consider properly this point. This was a position that was put forward very, very strongly, both by the government and the social partners when they started negotiating with the Troika back in 2016, but again, nothing happened. An important thing, a final very important thing that also came up in our discussions was that all of them said that any discussion about employment relations, any discussion about changes in the labour market need to consider the productivity model, the growth model for the country. It is wrong to discuss changes in employment relations without considering how these changes will impact on the growth model or what we want for Greece to achieve in the future. And this final quote by the about interviewing the ESA pinpoints this thing exactly. I deliberately include a quote from the ESA here, not from the Employer Association, because we cannot expect that the employers are interested in growth. But what is very central here are those bold letters that we have discussed all these years about decentralization, etc., etc., as if deregulation will lead to growth. We have not sat down together to consider how we can plan growth strategies together. What is needed? How are we going to generate new jobs? How are we going to increase business revenues and GDP to envision a different philosophy with a different strategy? I believe that this course sums up very well what the social partners, how the social partners now in 2018 perceive themselves. And this is something very, very important. They do realize that things have changed. They do realize that quite a lot of discussion needs to take place, and changes must take place, of course, but it's very important to sit down and actually consider growth. It's very important to actually sit down and consider development. And this can only happen through a social dialogue. And this was, you know, the final and most important point that everybody discussed. You can find, I think I'm minus three. You can find the full project report here in this link. It's a big report. It's around 200 pages, if I remember correctly. And the Greece paper, about this particular presentation has already been published, so you can download that. We include quite a lot of quotes in this paper, which better clarify the argument. We have some quantitative analysis as well regarding productivity and wages. And the full report says the whole story. If you thank you very much for your attention, and we're more than happy to take questions.
Presenters and the whole team for the work that you did. I'm sure there's many issues that can be picked up. I have a few, but I'll open it to the floor first and chip in. Kevin?
Thanks, I enjoyed the presentation very much, and it's intriguing. One part of me feels that there isn't a surprise in the sense that the response of the social partners seemed to be perhaps predictable from their structural position. If there's to be disagreements amongst the coalition of employers, you would expect large employers to take the position they did, and the SMEs to take the position that they have. But I was intrigued by your comment that the social partners were prepared to broaden the agenda of this discussion to go beyond wage setting. And in the context of a history of little social pact politics in Greece, that seems to be intriguing. But I wonder how robust that commitment was. I mean, I might use it as a smokescreen for my opposition to other things. It sounds good, but what was the depth of that that reality? So I think my first point is to question, did they mean what they said about we're prepared to broaden the discussion? The second question, the second point, I think, seems to be on the point about future growth models. And the word that seemed to hover over your presentation was that of ownership. Who was taking ownership of this agenda? And your slides were referring to the Troika denying this. But of course, there's something called the government in between as well. And we might say that the Troika, we could well say that the Troika was preventing a domestic discussion about future growth models. But was that in contrast to the relevant governments at the time? It wasn't. Didn't seem to be obvious to me that governments were trying to lead public debates to look at the next 5 years, the next 10 years, etc., to take ownership of a growth model agenda. So perhaps the contrast isn't between the Troika and the social partners. If we think of other bailout cases, then perhaps the contrast is between successive Greek governments and their peers in other member states.
Mm-hmm. So we collect a couple more.
Yes, you cannot answer the question in time.
I need more time. Yes.
Whatever you want.
Yeah. Okay. Yanni.
Has there been any attempt to cross-check with what they do, as distinct from what they say? This is important for a whole number of reasons, of course, although difficult. I appreciate very much the analysis of what they said. But I'm a bit puzzled also, like Kevin, with certain aspects of it. How do we reconcile, for example, the statement that they're broadening their attitude, they're ready to for incremental change, while at the same time they defend the acquired rights at all costs. Acquired rights, you don't surrender. It's what do they do in practice? How do they behave? How do they reconcile the two positions? Difficult question, but I think, if possible, worth attempting to ask.
Can I bring in a question on that topic as well? Some of the claims about also in the report, but in the report, I had the obligation to look at. You know, the arguments are made exposed about where they didn't let us get involved, and that assumes that automatically that if they were involved, a good outcome would be produced. Yeah, to put it very bluntly, and a critic would say that well, actually, part of the problem was that they, you know, you had tripartite negotiations before, and that led to the crisis. So to claim that well, you know, as a solution to the crisis, you should let me, you know, keep the Troika out, keep the statutory definition, you know, sort of, definition of the minimum wage out, and let the social partners define what the minimum wage was. Well, but, I mean, the perception at least was that was the problem that, you know, created all, you know, all the derailment, you know, very fast wage increases, and loss of competitiveness, and so forth. So, like linking really to the previous two questions, do you think there was, you know, while the claim was being made, over, you know, in the quotes, there was also a reflection about the past role and what lessons learned, how things would have been different, you know, how the individual organizations would behave differently, but also the tripartite negotiations would be functioning in a different way.
Okay. Shall I go first?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. I'll try to answer all the questions at the same
time. They are interrelated.
Yes, they are very interrelated. So, yes, I'll give an answer. If I haven't answered one of your questions, please ask me again. So, I'll start with you, Vasily, and the point you're making, which is, it is an interesting point in a sense, and it is something that we also thought about when we were actually, you know, preparing for the interviews and reading our material, etc. And When I had the first interviews back and I was discussing with my colleagues here, this point actually emerged. I don't want to go into the discussion on whether, you know, they are responsible for the situation or not. Let's leave this aside for a moment. But you said that, you know, if they were involved in implied that the good outcome of Woods would exist and so on and so forth. I don't know if one can claim that, nor can I say that the social partners actually claim that necessarily. What they claim is that we do have more knowledge of the labour market and of the peculiarities, if you wish, of the Greek system, both the Greek economy and the Greek labour market, than, you know, other outsiders may have, like the Troika. And we would love the opportunity, we want the opportunity to actually put our agenda forward. Whether this would lead to a better outcome or not, nobody can say, of course. Perhaps it would lead to a much worse outcome, okay, or to a better outcome than the one we have. What I can say for sure, however, from our discussions, is that what I sensed and what I saw by analyzing the interviews, that the social partners now, actually when I took the interview back in 2016, were much more mature, if you wish, than they were 3 or 4 years ago. And this is something that came up in the discussion with the official representatives of these organizations. And by comparing what was going on and what they were saying in 2010, 2011, etc. And this was something that they also, you know, they repeated quite a lot of times. That's, you know, we didn't know about. We were not aware of, you know, how big this crisis was or how it would evolve. But we have learned our lesson, we have learned things through this process. Now, whether they actually mean what they say or not, this is a very good question indeed. And it's very difficult to be answered, as you can appreciate. There is this thing that you very correctly mentioned, whether we cross-check what they say with what they do, is important as well. We didn't go into that much depth, to be honest, but we do have quite a lot of anecdotal evidence through our discussions and in the interviews, etc., where we see that the social partners do try to change that approach to things. And this goes back to your question as well, Kevin, about whether they actually mean what they say about growth. To give you a very small example, okay, when I was discussing with SAA, they gave me the example of the port of Piraeus and of the shipping industry in Perama and so on and so forth. As you know, the shipping industry in Greece is facing a huge crisis at the moment, quite a lot of unemployment, especially in Perama and Piraeus. It's a very dreadful situation. And what they said was that in collaboration, we, SAA, and our local, let's say, employers association, and in collaboration with the local unions, the shipbuilding unions, we sat down and we created programs to retrain these employees, to provide new skills, and you know, we have very good workers in the shipbuilding industry, very good welders, for example. They don't have a job, they cannot weld ships anymore, so we retrain them to work in the petroleum industry. Or in other industries, so we apply these skills and so on and so forth. So there were elements of collaboration there between trade unions and employers in order to promote growth, in order to improve employment opportunities and so on and so forth. We haven't seen huge collaborations, of course, yet, exactly because, as the last quote said, everybody is concerned about preserving what can be preserved. And this goes back to your point as well, defending their acquired rights, which is not something that one can, it's not something peculiar, if you think about it. Whether this defense has to do with a fetishism of rights, or with an attempt by the social, or with an understanding of the social partners that, these rights are important for the future of the country, is again of this importance. Both the small employers and the ESA, they have common lines here, did argue that, collective bargaining, secular collective bargaining is very important for the future of the economy, the growth of the economy. And we have as well quite a lot of empirical evidence from the international literature pointing to this direction. So I wouldn't necessarily interpret this kind of behavior as a fetishism to preserve what's already exists. But perhaps one can say that this is something that is a result of thinking, of research that these organizations have conducted, that shows that perhaps the sectoral approach, the sectoral collective bargaining, let's say, is a much better way to improve the situation, improve the economy than individualized collective bargaining or individualized bargaining in that sense. The role of the government here is crucial, and we haven't analyzed it that much in our report, to be honest. And the reason we haven't analyzed that much is because it's very difficult to actually find empirical evidence of how the governments behaved, at least behind the scenes. And I believe that perhaps this is a job for the future historian, the current sociologist of labor. I do know, however, and this is something that is funny and very worrying at the same time, if one tries to understand how the government behaved, how the individual ministers behaved back then from 2010 onwards, one will have a very, very difficult time to find hard evidence about it, because no minutes have ever been taken in these meetings that took place behind the closed doors. So one can only reconstruct what happens through parliamentary meetings, perhaps in the parliamentary meetings or through interviews with the ministers or people who were involved in this process.
It's a pity they didn't use tape recordings like the Papadakis.
Yes, but
and then publish a book, perhaps.
But this hasn't any place, so perhaps Varoufakis' book would be the only evidence that the future historian may have to build the reconstruct the history of Greece of that period. And this is very small evidence as well, as I'm sure you appreciate. So the role of the governor here is crucial, and it is a very, very important research question in that respect. We do not necessarily know what the role of the governor was. We may assume, we listen to stories, we have stories, anecdotal evidence, but nothing hardcore, let's say, that one can put in the report or in the paper in that sense. So I will leave this question unanswered if you don't mind, Kevin.
Running the danger of sort of repeating Horan's answer in other words, I would say that all these are very good questions. Undoubtedly, Greece has a very small history of social pacts, not very impressive one, but there has been an argument that this setting of the minimum wage every 2 years by collective bargaining has functioned as an equivalent of social pacting in other countries. So there have been elements of consensus in the system even before the crisis. And our first reading of our material suggests that the crisis has provided a moment of reflection, and there may be a learning process somewhere there going on to reflect what we have done wrong in all the previous years. Of course, in their own accounts, different social partners have sort of accepted some of the mistakes in terms of how they treated the system and how the system worked in the previous years in terms of the magnitude of the wage increases year after year. So there are sort of varying degrees of acceptance of blame. But still it seems that there is a reflection going on. As Horan suggested, they appear more mature than in the past. Not necessarily compared to advanced systems in Western Europe, advanced employment relations systems in the West, but compared to themselves, so Greece after the crisis and Greece before the crisis, there are elements of maturity. There are also slight pieces of evidence that even during the crisis they could come together and come up with joint positions, either position statements or even a collective agreement that was never implemented because then the Troika came in and the government.
And such was the example of the statement that we make that they made in the summer of 2016.
So there are elements there that suggest that they can sort of recalibrate the system consensually after this moment of crisis, but they were not given the opportunity. A recurring theme in our interviews is that they emphasize that though these are extraordinary times, abnormal times, and we need to return to normality, kanonikotita, the term that has been used in the Greek public dialogue frequently. We need to return to normal times in order for us to come together and rethink what the appropriate level of the minimum wage should be, what the appropriate model for setting up the minimum wage should be. And that was sort of a silver lining, so to speak, that they were open to learn and find out about new models of setting the minimum wage, like low pay commission. Mm-hmm. But the problem, first and foremost, was that they never got to that stage discussing appropriate new models of setting the minimum wage with their involvement or not. So the answer could only be that once we return to normality, we will find out whether what they say is really what they mean, or just sort of it's a smoke screen that sort of is put out there in order to avoid further involvement. I mean, it was interesting about the growth model sort of discourse. Again, it was something that was sort of put out there, but it's on the waiting until we return to the normal times. Our understanding was that all the policies implemented in the labor market was the Troika twisting the arm of the government as part of fiscal conditionality, strict bailout packages, and there was absolutely no room for maneuver whatsoever. So no point in being involved in the first place. So there are elements of optimism, if I may say so, but we will only know once we return to normality.
Can I offer a very short addendum? Because I do think that all three questions, in a way, relate to this notion that the sincerity of the social partners, insofar as their perceptions of what has happened and their perceptions of the efficacy of the changes, is in doubt. Now, both Warren and Andreas have already spoken to that, but the very short point that I'd like to make is that regardless of our own perception of the social partners' sincerity, regardless of our possibility of judging their sincerity, the consistency between their theory and their practice, their word and their deeds, part of what our findings, our data show is that the claim of the social partners, and please correct me if I'm wrong, I'm referring to both social partners and state agency interviewees, is that there is a potential lack of understanding, a potential lack of appreciation on the part of the Troika or the Greek government of the nitty-gritty, the details in the application of particular institutional changes. And I'll give a very short example that I recall from our interviews regarding the association of persons. Horan has spoken extensively about it already, but part of the reason why the institution of the association of persons as a trade union light that can negotiate a collective agreement at the level of the enterprise did not work in Greece is because in particular industries where there is a high level of temporal and temporary part-time employment, like tourism industry, the Association of Persons Institution, was heavily manipulated by specific employers that would come up with or help create an association of persons during the winter months when they employ five employees, and the collective agreement that would be concluded in this way would then cover the 50 or 60 employees that would be temporary part-time employees, workers that would be employed during the summer months. And this is part of what the social partners are claiming, I think, in terms of why it was such a big deal that they were pushed out, that there was no genuine social dialogue. There was a lack of appreciation of how particular institutional changes would work on the ground.
So if anybody didn't appreciate that they were stooges of the employers, then they must be pretty dim.
Perhaps.
They're stooges. No question about it.
That's true.
I mean, just to put it in a sentence, it was a one-size-fits-all sort of policy, and then that didn't take into account the Greek idiosyncrasy and peculiarities of the Greek context, and that comes out of the interviews.
Okay, let's move on. I want to ask, please. Very, very recently, maybe 5 hours ago or a few more hours, the SEV, the large employers of the Greek Industrialist Federation, published an opinion about the minimum wage, no, the next collective agreement. And they say, they argue specifically in favor of decoupling the minimum wage, or the statutory minimum wage, from the collective. For the collective agreement, which actually goes against something you said, that all partners still want tripartite determination of the minimum wage.
I haven't read what SEV says, so I cannot probably comment.
Okay, but from the material, recognizing that the interview material happened in 2016 mainly, was there this understanding that the minimum wage sets wage floors, which basically protect, you know, kind of minimum job quality and social standards, and then wage negotiations happen on specific industrial occupation or whatever characteristics which can diverge more or less from whatever we consider the minimum wage. So, like, was there any sign of this kind of, I would call it maturity of the debate about wage setting, but others may call it a negative development of the debate about wage setting. But were there any signs that would point in this direction, that, you know, perhaps collective agreements and minimum wage are not things that should be integrated? You know, because one of the problems were the internal evaluation argument was when the minimum wage was reduced in Greece, all wages were indexed to the minimum wage, all wages were down. So it was de facto an internal evaluation. Whereas in another country, if you reduce the minimum wage, well, 80-90% of people would not be affected. So it would be only secondary effects, how wages may go down by comparison, but it wouldn't be indexed. They wouldn't be indexed on
indexed, but there might be ripple effects.
Yes, but there would be secondary. There wouldn't be.
May I correct you here? The index of sectoral agreements related to the minimum wage is, when the minimum wage was reduced, it didn't necessarily mean that automatically wages in the sectoral agreement would be reduced, if that's what you mean by index.
No. Okay, no, but the collective agreements are often, you know, the
big house
was in the big two, yeah, the minimum wage plus something.
Yeah.
Okay, so when you reduce the minimum wage, then
the way wages were reduced in Greece was through the ability that the Ministerial Act of number 6 of 2011 provided to 2012 provided to companies to actually unilaterally, if they wish so, to decide to unilaterally reduce their wages to the level of the minimum wage without any consideration what the sectoral agreement said. So you could, if you were a company, let's say, that had that was under the auspices of any sectoral agreement, decide unilaterally without asking anybody to reduce the wage of the workers to the level of the national minimum wage. And since the level of the national minimum wage was reduced to 580 euros, this of course led to a reduction of wages.
Okay, but forget my that comment.
Okay,
so
just for the record.
Good, thanks. I stand corrected. But the question is whether you think there were any signs in the discussions you've had in 2016 about the thinking of the social partners developing in the direction of what is proposing.
As I said, I don't know what's proposed.
Okay. Decoupling of the minimum wage setting to the
decoupling of the minimum wage may mean that the minimum wage can still be negotiated, but it will be a different thing, and the collective agreement will include other terms of conditions of employment. So I don't know if SEV means, I haven't read it, so I cannot say, whether they mean that the national minimum wage still needs to be negotiated, but as an independent, let's say, variable, and whether a collective agreement should include other terms and conditions of employment, which, you know, is something that can be put on the table. We didn't see any evidence of that back in 2016, if that's your question.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we did see part of the recalibration of sort of the institutional setting We did see that they accepted that the role of the agency for mediation arbitration needs to be reconsidered, and how it operated in a way to transmit the increases in the national minimum wage into the rest of the collective bargaining framework. Sort of taking the increases in the minimum wage as a pattern and then sort of transferring those in different sectoral agreements, irrespective of taking into account productivity in different sectors and so on and so forth. And at least some of the social partners did accept that that was a bit problematic and that was something to sort of reconsider.
Yeah, but it's a very small, let's say, amount of sectoral agreements that there were some through made anyway, back then in the good old days. The majority of the sectoral agreements were signed through collective bargaining, through, or they were concluded at the level of the mediation, which is very important, not the arbitration level, which is compulsory for both signatory parties.
Just a comment on whether the dissociation between doing and saying implies insincerity. I don't think it does, because you can argue that you're in favor of broadening, of making progress slightly, slowly, but surely. You can argue that on the basis of that you're doing this, in fact, not only saying it, on the basis that there are a few snippets which in your mind, though, take big dimensions and which justify your position. However, for the third party, looking at the events would be insufficient to reconcile doing and saying. I mean, I can reconcile myself things that I say and I do, which a third party cannot do. They find them inconsistent.
Personally, not generalizing. Okay, we have a few more minutes if there's any other questions or comments. Okay,
Can I add a footnote to what Yanis has just said? I think that's a very good point, and that comes back to the question then of how government might redefine the contest or the policy debates. It may well be difficult for outsiders to understand the complex context of domestic politics in Greece. In that situation, the role of government can be decisive if government is able to somehow establish credibility, take ownership, all of those things which didn't really happen.
Can I conclude with a political economy question? Maybe may have a very quick answer, actually. So the issue came up about the second of the small employers being much more mindful about the internal the implications of the internal variations of collapse in domestic demand compared to the large employers who were less concerned about that. And so one is whether they rely on domestic demand and the other, whereas the others are more export-oriented. And this takes us to that kind of, secluded, kind of exposed, protected sector of the economy, which is kind of a debate in a particular part of comparative political economy. I'm sure theirs knows us very well. The other, of course, may know less well or more well. Is this, would you think that you can map directly to this literature about protected and exposed sectors the example of the serf versus serf that doesn't completely match, or there's some sort of domestic differentiation, it's more complicated than that. Is it a simple explanation that the exporters versus the domestic demand guys, or is there something else?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure that all the members of serf are exporting really. So maybe they're trying to export, but not necessarily they're exporting. it does map to some extent. So part of our explanation is, of course, these things that SMEs representatives like SA and SAV are more inward oriented, so they rely a lot on the disposable income, domestic demand, so they want to keep minimum wages high, keep their staff as well happy, and don't, you know, try not to break personal relationships in sort of small income size settings, but also rely a lot on domestic demand. With SEV, it's sort of that story, but also so one part of the story is that they might rely more on exports, or they just do not represent particular coherent sectors in the economy. So it's the structure of the representation. So maybe large enterprises in very different sectors of the economy that they don't have an incentive to abide by any particular sectoral agreement. I mean, these small versus large employers divide with regard to collective bargaining can play both ways, and it has played both ways in different countries and at different historical periods. So in some cases, it has been the large employers trying to support collective sectoral bargaining so that they don't, so that they sort of discipline their own employees, keep them happy, retain social peace, and try to avoid facing unfair competition from the small employers who might be more flexible, for example. They might prefer more flexibility, and they might see collective agreements as a straitjacket, but it can play the other way around, like in the case of Greece, where the small employers want really the sectoral level of bargaining to exist, because it sort of provides a level playing field vis-a-vis the large employers, who are able, the large employers might be able to give higher wages anyway. So in that case, the small employers would like to be protected through collective agreements, sectoral agreements. The interesting thing here is that some of the current literature is trying to link institutional changes, debates with growth models, and we're trying sort of to tap on that wave and try to sort of see this research under the light of this new literature, and how a credit-based domestic demand growth model like the one in Greece sort of suffered very much from the particular institutional changes. And
good luck with that. Thank you. Okay. We're out of time. Please join me.